Welcome, everyone, to the teleconference, Riding the Recovery. This is Alan Weiss. I'm glad that you're with me for this special teleconference. And, of course, who else would have the chutzpah to do a teleconference like this when the market has just had its worst second quarter in about, I don't know, a dozen years or so, maybe worse. But nonetheless, I believe we're in the midst of a recovery that not enough people appreciate. And one of the things, people say one of the good things about someone twisting your arm is that when it stops, it feels so good. And one of the good things about an economic problem on the dimensions that we had is that it has to recover, and it will recover not only profoundly after a while, but it will recover with sort of a new cleansing. And by that I mean that when you have this kind of a problem, it's not only Wall Street, but it's everyone's practices that begin to change and make things healthier. So if you recall back to the great bursting of the dot-com bubble, in the Silicon Valley bubble, when that burst, the companies that were left and the investments that were left were much sounder and much stronger. You see, Apple rising today is probably the most powerful technology company in the world, passing by Microsoft and passing by Google and so forth, by dint of the fact that it's producing great products appealing to very, very loyal customers. So the fact that as I'm talking to you, you know, about this today, Apple's down by 8 points doesn't really matter because you have to look at the long picture. And similarly today, you will find not only governments having cleansed their bad practices, stopping lying to each other and lying to themselves, as you see in Greece right now. I mean, that's going to be traumatic, but it's going to be worked out. And Britain is going to have to face the same kind of thing, even a country of that size and of that stature. You'll also find that not only large institutions and large investors, but small investors will find the same thing. For example, the private home is not the piggy bank it used to be. And people can no longer buy a home for, you pick the number, you know, $500,000, and expect to sell it two years later for $1 million. That's not happening anymore. And I remember many, many years ago, I'm an aficionado of exotic cars. I used to buy Ferraris to drive them. And I got my first one in 95. It wasn't too long before that that people were buying rare Ferraris for $1 million, hoping to sell them for $2 and $3 million a few years later. And I remember 10 years later running into a doctor who had $1.5 million Ferrari and still hadn't been able to sell it. So people get more realistic about what to expect, and these bubbles burst. And some of them, of course, are scams. Some of them are Bernie Madoff kinds of scams where they're Ponzi schemes. But some of them are people with just the wrong expectations because temporarily the market's rewarded things, but that reward can't go on forever. So the housing market obviously can't climb forever. Certain collectibles can't climb forever. Gold is up, gold is down, now gold's back up again. But the thing is, we're going to emerge with this cleansing having taken place, this purging, and the systems will be stronger than ever. You'll find that in your clients and your prospects. And so that's what I mean by riding the recovery. You ride it like you ride a bull or a wild horse. There'll be some bumps. There'll be some tremendous bursts of speed. There'll be some hiccups. But the idea is to stay in the saddle. So when we talk about riding the recovery, and the recovery that I believe is underway right now, don't forget, even though the market's down very recently, it's up significantly over where it was when this recession hit, and faster than anybody predicted. So with the recovery underway, here are five things that are required for you to think about. The first is your perception and your mindset. I cannot overestimate this. I think a large part of this recession was perceptual, and that is people felt worse and acted worse than they needed to. It's not to say that people weren't hurt. It's not to say that people weren't in trouble, but there was this overall sense of doom and gloom, and right now there are people trying to make money by telling you the sky is falling. There are people who predicted every day of their lives for the last 30 years that the market would collapse. And what do you know? Well, you hit a period like this, which is inevitable, really, and they said, see, I was right. Well, if they used that same philosophy on the roulette wheels in Las Vegas, they would have been bankrupt long ago. So your perception, your mental set has to be optimistic. I talked to too many people today who are cynical and skeptical. They sigh whenever they talk. Oh, I just got a client, but it's so much work. Even good news is skeptical. And so your perception must be positive that despite the roller coaster and volatile conditions of the economy, that you can not only survive but thrive because you have value to provide. Number two, consequently, who you listen to and hang out with is very important. Seligman, you know, Martin Seligman in Learned Optimism, spends a lot of time on self-talk. I want to talk to you here for a few seconds on other people's talk. Be careful to whom you listen, because there's a subliminal effect of language that if you hear often enough a bad refrain, a rotten song, you begin to sing that song, and you begin to sing it poorly. So hang around people who are positive, listen to people who are successful, adhere to advice that comes from people who are making it in the economy. Number three, you have to engage at all times in prudent risk-taking. There is no free lunch. And what people did with Bernie Madoff and similar Ponzi schemes is they thought they could get a lot for nothing, that there was no risk, just a great return. And it turns out the great return was not only not there, but the risk was far greater than they thought it would ever be, losing all your money. But you have to take prudent risk if you want to ride the recovery. And by prudent risk, I mean you have to spend money to develop yourself, to develop your products and services, and to develop your marketing. I get many too many questions from people. A buyer wants to see me. It's an hour plane ride away. It will probably cost me $1,500 to fly there and back. Should I do it? Well, yes, unless this is a hobby and not an occupation. $1,500 to see a real buyer is certainly worth the investment. In fact, if somebody said, if you give me $1,500, I'll set up a personal meeting with a buyer for you tomorrow. If I don't do it, you don't have to pay me. That's a pretty good investment. So prudent risk-taking means investing in yourself, investing in your business to get it ahead. Number four, you have to educate your buyers. Now, I'm going to spend a considerable amount of time on this a little later in this teleconference, but let me just say here in my top five, your buyers will be somewhat frightened at times. Your buyers will be under the same kind of pressures and misinformation that you find some of your colleagues under. You have to educate your buyers. You have to explain to them why this is a great time to invest in you and their own performance and their own future. And finally, number five, your investment here has to be very clear to you. And the investment is not only money, which I mentioned a minute ago, but it's also time, and it's also psychic energy. You know, this is the worst kind of hard work. It's mental hard work. And I tell people who attend a lot of my workshops that you're about to have the worst kind of hard work, even though we're only going to work for 6 hours, and even though this is only one day or whatever it is, but it's the worst kind of hard work because it's mental hard work. You have to challenge yourself, you have to change some of your beliefs and your consequent behaviors. And so it's the money, and it's the time, and it's the psychic energy that have to be changed in terms of your priorities so that you can ride the recovery the way you should. So let me talk about some of these dynamics and how to change them. You've heard some of them perhaps before related to other things, but I've brought them together. I've brought disparate elements together for the power of this teleconference. Number one, you have to bring new products and services to existing clients. You cannot think about, in terms of a mindset, you cannot think about going back to past clients with whom you had even a great relationship, but they haven't done, you haven't done anything for a year or so, or you've been on sort of a maintenance kind of schedule, and do more of the same. You must bring new value because the cutbacks have been in the traditional, because the traditional has been deemed not to help that much in non-traditional times. So you have to step into the non-traditional, but still build on the great relationship that you have. And so you take this wonderful relationship and you introduce new products and services. That means you have to start translating your intellectual capital into intellectual property that your clients will find desirable to the point that they want to invest in it because of the return on that investment in terms of improving their condition. So based on the credibility and trust that you have with your existing clients, now's the time to introduce new products and services. And that means now's the time to develop them if you don't have them, or to enter into alliances where you can introduce them on behalf of someone else, or whatever it takes to get that done. But now is the time to do this. Now is the most propitious time to do it. Secondly, with new clients now, you want to provide your existing products and services because they are new to those clients. It's new to them. So based here, not so much on credibility and trust because you haven't established that yet, but based on testimonials and referrals, you want to bring new clients, your tried and true existing products and services. And so what this dynamic does is it introduces new things to both existing clients and new things to new clients. It just takes different variations to do that, but you have to segregate them. And you have to understand what's new to someone. People want something new now. They want to adjust to new times. And what you have to do is provide something they perceive as new. Perception is reality. So how do you approach these existing and new clients? First of all, it's not situational. That is, it's time to approach everyone that you can. Don't wait for the best possible time. Don't wait for your client to be in a certain condition. Don't wait for your product and service to be in a certain state of development. Do it now. Now is the time to get ahead of the curve. Now is the time to start the ball rolling. And if you don't conclude the sale immediately, at least you'll start things in sequence. You'll start things in progress. You'll start things in motion. So don't wait for the right time. Make this the right time. Next, demonstrate best practices to them. In other words, this is a window of opportunity to lead. And what you want to tell them is, just as you, in fact, are leading in your profession by providing these new ideas, they should be leading their clients, their customers, their members, whatever it happens to be, by stepping out now and saying, we're ready for this new world, we're ready for the recovery, we're ready to deal with the volatility that we know will continue, that with the ups and downs as the horse kicks and bucks. We know about this, but we're prepared to lead, and you need someone to lead you. A second best practice is that you have to recognize that customers are there. Now, I can think of no greater example, and this is a hackneyed example, that everyone and their dog is using right now. It's an expression I picked up in Australia, which I love, as Koufax is sitting here looking at me, wondering where his involvement is. But everybody and their dog is talking about Apple right now. My son-in-law is here. He said, look, I got the new iPhone 4. My manicurist yesterday had it on her desk. She makes all her appointments through her iPhone. She says, here's the new iPhone 4. Mine's on order. Should be here in 3 weeks because I'm not a fanatic about having it first. But everybody's buying this phone. Apple just sold a gazillion iPads. Now they're selling, 10 gazillion of these new iPhones. Customers are there. Apple knows how to reach customers who are there. People are spending money. So there's no such thing as your customers abandoning you, but there is such a thing as you abandoning your customers because you don't provide them with new value, new perceived value, because you don't reach out to them, because you don't stay in contact. These politicians who send me a flyer or a newsletter a week before the election to tell me what they've been doing don't get my vote. The people who stay in touch with me once a quarter get my vote because they're reaching out to me and staying in touch with me. And the same thing with your customers. You have to be current with them. They have to have seen you. Your face has to be familiar. Your name has to be familiar. Your value has to be familiar so that you're not approaching them out of the blue. Customers are there. They're there to be nurtured. So that's another best practice. Another best practice is you have to react to trends, not the current day. So in other words, I deliberately mentioned this is the second quarter of 2010. It's been a terrible quarter for the market. But the market is still up considerably from its low post-recession, and the market is still hovering around 10,000 as I speak. It tends to go down by 200 points. It tends to go up by 200 points. You can't react to a given day. You have to react to longer-term trends. Now, by that I mean the following. People talk about unemployment going up, but also you have to consider that when unemployment goes up, it also means that people who had given up looking have re-entered the job search and now are classified as unemployed, whereas before they were off the chart. That happens to be a good sign. So if you find that jobs are up and unemployment's also up, those two things start to make sense together. Housing has begun to rebound. Both new housing and resale housing has begun to rebound. Autos have begun to rebound. You'll find that once the stimulus packages are completed, and some of them are now completed, that particular Band-Aid will be ripped off. The scab will come with it. There'll be a little more bleeding. That's to be expected. The long-term trend is better than that. But don't be fooled by the day or two where people are talking about, oh, gee, the stimulus is gone, and people have stopped buying appliances because there's no more credit. They've stopped buying a car because they're not getting the same credits for it. That, too, will change. This is a consumer economy. And you'll see the longer-term trends will be positive. Next, they have to educate their customers. So I said before, you have to educate your clients. Your clients have to educate their customers. This is one huge educational process. And so consequently, the good news is that that's cheap. It doesn't take a capital investment. It just takes volition. It takes some energy. It takes some initiative. The bad news is that we're not doing it very well. We're not educating our customers well, and they're not educating their customers well. So you have to step into that void. But if you want to approach existing and new clients and help them to ride this recovery and help you to ride the recovery, they have to understand that it's now a window of opportunity to be a leader, where they might not have been a leader before. Or if they were a leader, they have to reassert that leadership now. Second, the customers are there, and it's a question of reaching out to them in the right way and creating some excitement. Third, they have to be reactive to trends and not just a particular day here and there. What are the long-term patterns taking place? I'm not talking about fads. I'm talking about trends. And fourth, they have to educate their clients, their customers, their consumers at all times. They have to rule that roost. They have to be the primary voice that they hear in terms of educating them about their products and services. Now, that's a problem, this last one, because of the noise level out there. And to me, the noise level right now is tremendous. It is a cacophony. One of the funny things, the truly funny things about social media platforms is that the advocates will tell you that they amplify. The trouble is, when you amplify everything, you just have louder noise. And so the point is to stand out in the crowd, not to be a part of the yelping masses. If you watch the World Cup and you've heard these crazy horns, I can't even pronounce them, the Valvuela, whatever they are, they create such a racket that they disturb even the TV viewership. They disturb the players, the coaches, the officials, everybody. And you have the stadium of just outrageous noise. Nobody knows, you know, what it means. Is it good? Is it bad? Are you rooting for me? You're rooting for them? It's just ridiculous. And so you have to stand out above this crazy, crazy noise level. Now, one way to do that is there's a vacuum of high content in the media. And you can fill that need. This is a time to be provocative. It's time to be contrarian. It's time to really get the light centered on you, get the focus on you. There is so much in terms of media outlet today, electronic and hard copy. And not all, it doesn't have to be major. Somebody says the other day, you know, my goal is to have an article printed in the Wall Street Journal. And I said, well, forget about it. The Wall Street Journal doesn't even print independent articles. They don't use freelance articles. And that's not the point. But you're better off if your buyer is an insurance brokerage owner. You're better off in a newsletter that says insurance brokerage ownership today, because now you're reaching your targeted audience. And the great thing about the Internet is not that it was made for porn, and it's not that they don't know you're a dog. The great thing about the Internet is that it's the ultimate repository of highly specialized content. Okay, I want to say that again. This was taught to me by a client who is a master in Internet advertising. And what he told me was, the thing you always have to remember about the Internet is it's the ultimate repository of particular quality content. And so, if you're interested in hybrid off-color polar bears, you'll find a website for that. If you're interested in left-handed fly fishing, you'll find a website for that. And there's so much of this specialized content, because it's so easy to find on the Internet, that you can find yourself writing for specialized publications that cater just to your audience. And so that'll it. And some of them are hard copy, too. There are, for example, if you're in the small business arena, there are all kinds of small business newsletters that are hard copy, weekly newspapers and magazines and things like that in every state I've ever been in. And so try to fill that vacuum by becoming a leader in these fields. Next, if you want to get above the noise level, gain endorsements. Call them testimonials, call them endorsements, call them third-party support, I don't care. But, of course, once you're published anywhere, you tacitly have third-party endorsement, because you've got the endorsement of the editor and or publisher. And so that's very powerful. But here are six other things that you can think about in terms of gaining endorsements. One is through local colleges. Create some kind of relationship with a local college or university. I mean, it could be a full-fledged university or a college or a private school or a community college even, something like that. Now, when I say a relationship, you might teach. You might teach as an adjunct professor, as a visiting instructor. You might teach a night a week, or you might come in four or five times over the course of a semester to teach in a professor's course as a visitor. However, you might do some pro bono work for them. You might do some pro bono work in strategy, or pro bono work in community relationships, or community work in conflict resolution, whatever it happens to be. You might join force with a particular department there and create thought leadership in the area of your specialty. going global with small business. I mean, who knows? Most of these places have various kinds of specialties and specialists among the faculty, and having a collaboration with an external entrepreneur and business leader can be very important. Some universities have a chair or have a specific opening for a community business leader. These are funded sometimes by donors that don't even come out of the university budget. So with a local school, an accredited local school, and it does, you know, we're not talking Harvard here, you can create the kind of third-party endorsement that will get you above the noise level because you will have a relationship with that academic, learned organization. Number two, weekly newspapers. I talked about these before. You know, I think that the large newspapers are going to disappear, and, you know, you'll have the national editions of the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and USA Today, and if you live in Cincinnati or Denver or Austin, you'll simply subscribe to the local edition of those three papers. So the, you know, the Fort Worth Telegram and the Providence Journal and the San Francisco, you know, Examiner are going to go by the wayside. However, there are weekly newspapers that will stay in force. They will deal with their communities. Their community might be geographic. It might be for a given city. Their community might be demographic, small business, or a particular line of work or professional conduct or whatever it is. These weekly newspapers need content, and you can publish in those. And so it's almost easy. I might have overstated that, but let's say it's easier in those papers to get a column as well. And your column might be weekly or biweekly. Those of you familiar with Jeff Gittimer, he does a sales column that's syndicated. And it appears in 30 or 40 or 50 of these publications. Now, he might get, you know, $50 per publication or, you know, a few thousand dollars, whatever it is. But for him, the exposure and the ability to get in front of potential buyers, salespeople, sales managers, sales directors with his sales message is very, very important for him. And that's a great way to leverage that. So he rises above the noise that way. Number three, aggressive blogging. I have come to separate blogging from social media platforms. I think they're very different things, and I'm probably, frankly, late to that dance. In other words, I think a lot of people realize that before me. But my feeling is that blogging... Now, I continue to maintain there are 200 million blogs in the world. 99% of them are crap. Let me make that clear. You can't read them. They're written poorly. There's not even an author. They're inane. But the 1% of 200 million is still a significant amount. You know what? 10% is we're talking 2 million. And if you blog aggressively, by that I mean you appear 3, 4, 5 times a week. You're in hard copy. That is, you're in text, I should say. You're in audio, you're in video, you have links, you have connections to others, you have guest columns, whatever it is you want to do that keeps it varied, you will begin to develop a following. Now, the following is not based on numbers of people. I hear people talking about traffic, and they're talking about SEO, and they're talking about all this nonsense. You only need one hit. And so if you're a provocative, go back to what I said before, if you're provocative and contrarian in your commentary and your opinions and your sort of editorial work here, you will draw people. Now, I critiqued a blog the other day for someone, and it was totally promotional. You want your promotion to be literally marginal. And by marginal, I mean on the sides of the blog. In the blog itself, you want a diversity of material that helps people. You want a diversity of material that adds to people's good fortune, and that, again, the web is the ultimate repository of specialized quality. You want that to be aimed at the people whom you want to attract. You just need one hit. So by aggressive blogging, I mean two things. I mean, on the one hand, frequency, and on the other hand, I mean high-impact stuff that will cause people to say, whoa. I never, ever mind when I get commentary, and always allow commentary on your blog, that opposes me. If it's polite and professional, I will debate the person. If it's impolite, I will slap them right back again. If it's obscene, I simply delete it. So don't be afraid to get that kind of community involvement going. Number four, association alliances. There are 10,000 registered trade associations in the United States, to the best of my knowledge. If you're interested, the best source for this is National Trade and Professional Associations of the United States. It's in hard copy and electronic, and if you mention my name, you get a 20% discount. I have no financial connection, by the way, for those of you listening, but I refer so many people. I do that as a professional courtesy. In any case, these associations... are looking for leverage because associations are not going to survive anymore in this new future as the recovery continues by offering a monthly magazine and an annual conference. That's not enough. Association membership, with some exception, is largely down. Professionals in many areas of the United States and abroad have declining income, and they're blaming that on their associations in many instances. I mean, whether you look at architects or construction people, their incomes are declining. Legal incomes are declining. And so you pick the spot, but the trade associations are part of the problem because they're not sufficiently educating and improving the conditions of their members. And so if you can forge an alliance whereby you're bringing your thought leadership, you're bringing your quality, you're bringing your intellectual property to help their memberships, that's a wonderful endorsement to have. I've worked with everybody from the American Institute of Architects to the National Fisheries Institute and everyone in between. And sometimes it's just been to speak, sometimes it's been to set strategy, but sometimes it's as a collaborative partner. I was with the American Press Institute for 20 years, and that produced an amazing amount of work for me in the newspaper industry. So what kind of an alliance can you build with trade associations? Number five, if you want to gain endorsements, demonstrate your success. You need to blow your own horn. You need to provide evidence of how successful you've been with organizations. If you don't do it, no one else is prone to do it. And so in your blog, in your collateral material, in your conversations, drop in examples of how you've helped people. Now, if you can, drop in examples of how you help people during volatile times, during the recovery, as you've helped them adjust to a new world. Drop in examples of where and how you've done this. It doesn't matter if you've done it for fee or pro bono for free. Use the examples of how you've done it. That's what people want to hear. That's what they want to know about. And that will help you get above the noise level. The final thing I want to say to you here about the noise level, just in case, because I say it all the time, but you need to network for referrals. And so I'm saying to you, network, not for networking's sake, not with strangers in this case, network for referrals. You need to go through your contact list and ruthlessly ask for referral business. In the recovery, that will be more important than ever. And you need to formulate this. You need to frame it in terms of, I'm specializing, I'm working toward, I've had the experience in, however you want to say it, helping firms come through volatile times and work in this recovery that we're experiencing right now to varying degrees. Who do you know who I can help in that regard? Who do you know who's looking to take part in the recovery? Now, my next point, I talked earlier about the company that you keep. And so in terms of the company you keep, I want to suggest the following to you, five things. Number one is, if I were you, I would eschew professional trade associations. Now, I don't mean, you know, what I said earlier is form alliances with them. I don't mean don't do that. But what I mean is, as a member, these things are not very useful anymore. And whether you're a consultant or a speaker or a coach or a facilitator, no matter who you are in the sort of helping professions, those kind of professional services providers, most of these professional trade associations are just recycling stuff from 10 and 20 years ago. Most of the people who speak there are speaking because they want to sell you something. They want to sell you their product or a membership or something, or they're trying out their own material. My experience over the past few years, and I've made 50 or 60 appearances at consulting and speaking professional trade conferences, is that most of the people you hear there are not helpful. And most of the things you hear from people who are members are not helpful. Now, there are exceptions, but your time is rare. I talked about time, money, and psychic energy before, if you recall. Your time is rare. I think you have to be judicious about where you invest it. Number two. In terms of the company you keep, if you do eschew professional trade associations, then by all means, join communities. You want to be with communities of people with whom you can interact on a peer basis, and even with people who are ahead of you in the game, and find out what they're doing and what the best practices are. These are times, folks, when if you really want to ride the recovery, you need to find out what best practices are on a weekly basis or even a daily basis, because they change. Volatility creates that kind of a change. And so it's not what worked 2 weeks ago won't work today. It probably will, but there's probably something today that you can learn to add to it. So you have to constantly expand your repertoire, and the best way I found to do that, as somebody who's both formed these and been a member of them, is to join communities. And by my definition, communities of people who engage each other on a regular basis, either in person or electronically, you know, virtually or both, whatever it is, sometimes in developmental experiences, sometimes just in chat, sometimes over specific issues, and through them they form sub communities where they might have mastermind groups or just alliances or just close relationships, but they can constantly keep abreast of what's going on and rise above the fray. So join communities when you can. And as I mentioned, form mastermind groups from those communities. Now, somebody in a mastermind group has to be the smartest person in the room, but if you find you're the smartest person in the room, then leave after 3 months and go find someplace where you're not the smartest person in the room. So it's okay to help other people. You might learn something in so doing, but if it's clear you're the most successful person there, then leave. Find someplace else, because it's best if you're not the most successful person in the room long term. Attend high-level events. Find events that are intellectually stimulating. Find events that are run by thought leaders. Find events that are state-of-the-art, that are ne plus ultra, and attend those events. And that's the investment I talked about before, the money and the time. You have to be at these events because that's going to catapult you forward. And so don't shortchange your own development. And that leads me to, of course, get yourself stimulation. Get yourself involved with things that help you to create not only best practices, but help you to create new intellectual property. Most of us are lone wolves. And one of the great drawbacks, despite all the benefits of being a lone wolf, is that different people are stimulated in different ways. If you have high affiliative needs, being a lone wolf isn't going to help that. So think about ways that you can engage and get stimulation and stimulate others and produce new things. And that's the kind of new things you have to bring to your existing clients. Now, here's an example of what I'm talking about, so I'm not so abstract. And I think some of you will be able to do immediately what I'm about to suggest to you, and others perhaps are already doing it, and some of you, of course, will scoff at me. But scoffing's fine because I can't hear you. My advice to you is to create a wholesale retail mindset, because in the recovery, I think that these two dynamics will be very important. What I call wholesale means that a client organization provides a check for you. A buyer in a client organization writes you a check to do work for that organization, which involves many of its people in all probability. Now, they might be writing you a check just to coach a couple of people or to be on retainer to one person or whatever, but irrespective, it's an organization hiring you on behalf of the organization. Now, the retail market, the retail mindset I'm talking about, is the individual purchase. And that's someone who might be working for an organization but purchases your products and service out of their own funds, out of their own pocket. It might be an entrepreneur or a professional, someone who doesn't work for an organization, works for themselves. This can be profit or nonprofit, who knows. But both of these, see, there's what I call the hydraulic anomaly. You know, in a hydraulic system, if something goes down, something else goes up. And so if you push into a balloon, another part of the balloon will expand. If you press water down here, water goes up there. I'll stop here before I get into, you know, Archimedes' third law of aerodynamics or something. Who knows? But the anomaly I'm talking about is that both the wholesale and retail markets can go up at the same time. And that is something I found over the past couple of years that's astounding. I used to think, and I think it probably used to be true, that when the wholesale market went down, the retail market went up. In other words, when the economy turned sour, self-help went up. So you sold less to corporations and more to individuals. When the economy was strong, self-help would go down and organizational buying would go up. That's not true anymore. Both of them can go up right now. And it depends about how you stimulate them. It depends about how you appeal to them. But right now, we have a raft of individual development, a raft of people who want to develop themselves, that is, who are not going back to corporate environments. Just because the economy turns better and is turning better, they're not returning because they don't want their security at risk anymore. They think, and I mean, ironically, if you think about it counterintuitively, that there's more security working for yourself than for large companies, which was the exact opposite of when a lot of us went to work for large companies. And so you can appeal to both of these audiences today. So that's what I mean by have both a wholesale and retail mindset. Both of these can go up. So if you have intellectual property, if you have products and services that appeal to companies, think about how you can make them appeal to individuals. If you've basically appealed to individuals, think how that can appeal corporately. And there are some areas, negotiation, conflict resolution, decision making, I can go on and on, that apply to both very easily. There are others that you have to adjust. If you're doing team building for major organizations, you might say to me, how do I do team building for an individual? Well, individuals in their lives have to influence others. They have to create virtual teams. They have to work in the community. They have to work socially. They have to work civically. They have to work with clients and customers. And so just about anything can be adapted. Companies need strategies. Individuals need strategies. People in companies need career development. Individuals need career development. So think about the adjustments you want to make that are appropriate to take your wholesale strength to retail and your retail strength to wholesale. They are both, or can be both, vibrant markets. So think about what you offer in terms of coaching or training or career development or persuasion and influence and so forth, and apply them to both areas. This is eminently feasible, and I've been doing it for a long time now. What I found, amazingly, and of course, like most things I find, which are great insights, I found out accidentally, but at least I recognized it, is that the same kind of skills I use in organization development consulting, big ticket, big company organizational consulting, the same kind of skills I use in mentoring individuals. Things like language skills, things like framing skills, things like priority setting, things like pushback, and so forth and so on. They're exactly the same. You're just adjusting them for different environments. You can do that too. So in your speaking, in your writing, in your networking, whatever, focus on this duality, wholesale, retail. And consider the market gravity wheel that I talk about all the time. I'm not going to talk about it here, but for those of you familiar with market gravity and the different spokes of it, think about it in both dimensions. You're going to have, I mean, whether you're publishing or you're speaking or you're producing products or you're using a blog or you're doing pro bono work, I mean, whatever you're doing on the gravity wheel, think about how you might do it to attract wholesale business, but also to attract retail business. And if you think about the accelerant curve, think about an accelerant curve that might appeal to wholesale buyers and might appeal to retail buyers. If you're unfamiliar with the market gravity wheel or the accelerant curve, you can find both of these for free on my blog, contrarianconsulting.com. Just do a search and you'll find everything you need. Now let me talk for a few minutes about some new markets that I see as this recovery is underway. One is nonprofits. And I think that some of you who have been very successful in for-profits, or maybe if you haven't been successful in for-profits, I don't know, you should be looking at nonprofits. And the reason is this. The reasons are these. Most nonprofits, believe it or not, have money on hand. They might not be swimming in money, but they do have money on hand. They have endowments. They have capital campaigns. They have reserve funds. They have operating funds. There's money on hand. Number two, many of them have very important sponsorships from organizations with a lot of money on hand. So, for example, here in Providence, the local NBC affiliate helps to sponsor the entire season of Trinity Repertory Theater. And so it's great publicity for them and the community. But Providence isn't even one of the top 25 towns in the United States the last time I looked. And so there are these corporate sponsors who provide major funds that can be earmarked to nonprofits, and you could cash in on that if you position yourself well. Number three, there are corporate donations. So aside from these major sponsors, there are still companies making corporate donations, sometimes earmarked for special purposes, sometimes not, to these nonprofit organizations, and these provide discretionary funds for the nonprofits to use. Number four, there are wealthy donors for these nonprofits. Some of them might sit on a board or a task force or a committee. Some of them are subscribers. Some of them have vested interest. That is, the nonprofit helped their child or helped them. Some of them just believe in the cause. Some of them are just philanthropists. But for example, you know, we've sponsored dancers for the local ballet where the ballet had no money to bring in a guest star dancer. We've sponsored them for that performance. We're sponsoring one of the performances of a dance company in Newport in the next couple of weeks, among several performances they're having. And so wealthy donors can be approached by the nonprofit to sponsor what you're going to do. So if you're going to lead strategy for the organization, if you're going to help them set a human resources policy, if you're going to help them attract and retain staff talent, if you're going to help them reach out to the community for additional fundraising, I mean, whatever your particular strengths and assets and value happen to be, a donor might subsidize that. I've seen executive directors pay. I mean, I've seen $150,000 a year jobs completely subsidized by outside donors. And then finally, don't forget that some CEOs and executive directors of these nonprofits are paid $400,000, $500,000, $600,000 a year. You're dealing with major businesses, quote unquote. The blood banks in Florida, for example, some of the blood banks in Florida, I happen to know this because I was interviewed for the Sentinel down there by a reporter. And he was asking me about compensation and executive pay and so forth. And his story, and he ran a series of four or five of these stories, and he sent me the copies, and I was quoted in them. Some of these blood bank directors get $150,000, $250,000, even $400,000 directing blood banks, which are highly profitable. Again, profitable, quote unquote. Some of the members of the board do six figures in business with that nonprofit. They don't deem anything unethical about that, strangely. But it wasn't that long ago that when the executive director of the United Way, the national body in the United States, was fired, he was making over $600,000 a year. And so there's a lot of money in nonprofits, and people are surprised to hear that, but it's true. So in this new age, in this recovery, I think nonprofits are something to look at. You know, Peter Drucker had written before he died that he thought that volunteerism was the way to one of the greatest growing parts of the economy. He also said he thought the Girl Scouts was the best-run organization in America. So enough on that. A second place to look, unbelievably, is government. And the reason I say government is that there are grants around that government can use. I was on the board of a nonprofit, of a shelter for battered women, and I did strategy work for them pro bono, the exact kind of thing I'm describing to you. And a chief of police was on that board, as you might expect. And he said to me, Alan, I love the strategy work you've done. Would you do it for the police department? And I said, you know, my pro bono dance card is filled. He said, no, we have a federal grant, and we need to set strategy if we're going to be certified. Not every police department is certified, it turns out. And so I said, sit right down. And so you'll find that there still are grants out there. These things haven't stopped. The spigot hasn't been turned off. They're still out there. There's still stimulus money out there from the latest government venture to get the economy going. And although the president recently got sort of a cold shoulder at this big economic meeting, the G20 or whatever they are, in terms of more stimulus money, there is stimulus money in the United States. There is stimulus money elsewhere in some places that can fund new initiatives, and it's still there. A third aspect of government would be alliances with business, where you can get funded through these alliances. Some businesses lend an executive to a government agency, and for that matter, to nonprofits too, for 6 months or for a year, as a good deed, and as I think, frankly, is a good way to get PR. You can be involved in that, perhaps, and be paid to do it. The last thing I want to mention to you about government is the fact that if you happen to respond to a request for proposal, an RFP, be aware that the FAR Act, I believe that's F-A-R Act, which was passed in the United States, indicates that purchasers who produce RFPs may choose on the basis of highest value and not lowest cost. And the government, as we all know, has tons and tons of money. It prints money. And so if they can purchase on the basis of most value and not necessarily lowest cost, that's a great opportunity in this new economy. And, of course, if you can go sole source, which is the basis of your intellectual property in a book or some unique model, you can avoid the RFP process entirely. So let me hurry along here. Let me see. I have another 15 minutes, and I want to make quite a few more points. when you're looking in this recovery to do business, and I talked about new products and services, don't forget that part of the value you can provide is transferring skills. And so if you think about not just helping clients improve their condition, which I advocate and I've advocated forever, but also improving their skills to improve their conditions in the future, you'll find you'll even be more needed. So there's no such thing as transferring skills and not being needed anymore. Ironically, counterintuitively, it creates even more need. So what you want to do is work on high-impact issues for a client, but also where you can maximally transfer skills to make the client self-sufficient. That's where the most value is. And I think the age is coming where consulting relationships will be fairly short-lived, that is, each project's relationships, but there'll be a succession and multitude of projects if you produce in any one of them. And I think that production will be based on not only improving the client's condition or alleviating a problem, but transferring skills to that client, because there is not that much residual talent in clients anymore, and some residual talent they need. Over 12 years working with Merck, 12 or 15 different buyers. That's over 12 years, several million dollars, and that's not counting the spin-off business. So think about transferring skills as well as solving problems and improving conditions. Think about, in this recovery, licensing your intellectual property. Think about the duration of your license, whether it's a year, 2 years, or 3 years. Think of the scope of it, whether it's for that company or it's also its suppliers or customers. Think about having access to new intellectual property, where you automatically update them as you produce new things. Think about training trainers. You know, will you train internal people as part of transferring the skills over there? And think about this in both wholesale and retail. So, because you can, if you're a great coach, you can license or certify or help other coaches and become a master coach. I have a master mentor program where I help other people become mentors. That's on the retail side. Of course, in wholesale, you can license your intellectual property to large clients. So, again, what's the duration of your license? What's the scope of it? How widely can they use it? Will they have access to new IP? And will you do things like train trainers? And you can find that you can create a new world in licensing your intellectual property to existing clients in particular, but no reason why you can't to new clients as well. You know, I have a $495,000 offering, and that's where clients can license rights to Million Dollar Consulting, the Million Dollar Consulting College, and all of these related workshops and seminars I've created in other countries other than the United States. And so you can license it in discrete countries, say Italy or Australia or Vietnam or Portugal or something like that. And my shopping cart, which is run by Chad Barr and Chad Barr's group, has a funny thing. It says 495,000, and then it says how many. But, you know, I'm convinced that that's the way of the future and that you just need one or two hits there, and suddenly you've got a pretty interesting week. These things, by the way, are never a substitute for you. And so give your intellectual property away when you have to, when you think it's a good idea, when you want to take that prudent risk I talked about before, because you will find yourself more in need than ever. You'll find yourself more wanted than ever. So use your IP judiciously to help prime the pump, to help stimulate people wanting you as this recovery continues. People, as the recovery continues, even as it has its ups and downs, people are going to want leverage to make the most of it. You're the one who has to show them you can leverage them through your value. And this brings me to a formula that I've been fooling around with for a while, and I kind of like it. I call it IC to IP to IB, and that is intellectual capital to intellectual property to income that's bankable. Because if it's not bankable, then what's the point? And so you can only bank something that you can sell, and that's intellectual property. But intellectual property has to originate somewhere, and it originates in your intellectual capital. So here are nine ideas I have for you, and I'll show you how these overlap. Number one, in terms of the intellectual capital, start right now to create a great ideas folder, quote-unquote great ideas. Start a great ideas folder. And as you have a great idea, at night, in the morning, driving the car, I don't care where, have a recorder with you, pull to the side of the road, jot a note, but capture your great ideas. And each week, take a look at them and see if you can combine some or whatever, and then get going. I was sitting at the pool a couple of days ago, and I had this great idea for a book where the entire book would constitute of three excellent people interviewing me. And I'm going to put that in action in the next week or so. I've already got two of the three interviewers. So I wouldn't have captured that. I would have forgotten it if I hadn't written it down right away. And I wrote it down on an iPad, by the way. And so you have a variety of ways to do this. I could have turned on my iPhone and used the recording switch on there. Record these great ideas, take a look at them, and figure out whether they can be pragmatically put to work. Number two, in terms of intellectual capital, create some filters for yourself. And the filters I would use would be these, to see if intellectual capital makes sense. Will it have a high impact? Will it attract a large audience? Is it original to you? Is it pragmatic and implementable? And so I'll run by that again. But intellectual capital should meet these filters. Will it have a high impact on people? Will it create, attract, impact a large audience? Is it original to you? Is it pragmatic and implementable? So it's not just high concept, high ideas. Number three, then, and this is where you start to bridge from intellectual capital to intellectual property, create the conceptual framework. And the conceptual framework can be a model, a graphic, a sequence, but what will this look like? And so in this book I talked about, I decided that it would be a book, but we would do audio interviews with me, which would also make it into an audio book right from the outset. And I decided it would cover a variety, the whole gamut, really, of consulting issues. And the interviews would be based on subtopics in these consulting issues. So what's the model, graphic, or sequence? What's the formulation you want to create for the transfer? Number four, what's the best conveyance or transfer mechanism? Is it text? Is it audio? Is it video? Is it a workshop? Is it interactive? Is it a combination of the above? And the more you can create combinations, the more leverage you'll have. But what's the best formulation of your intellectual capital into intellectual property that will sell? And a lot of that will be given your audience, your brand, your input, your reach, and so forth and so on. Number five, promote your value to the designated audience. And so whatever you've come up with now has to be promoted. So now we're bridging from the intellectual property to the income that's bankable. And this needs promotion. You need to blow your own horn. You need to understand how you want to leverage this so the maximum number of people hear about it. That means you need a good list. You need a good distribution system, or you need alliances that can get this out, or you need great publicity where people are going to quote and cite what you've got, but you need some splash to get this stuff in front of your buyers. Number six, you have to price this intelligently for the value that it's creating. So what's the price point you want to create? It's very difficult to change prices, and so be careful about the price point that you create for whatever the transfer mechanism is. Number seven, adjust and add formats, recycle it and repurpose it. And so as your new idea gets traction, add to it. When I started the mentor program, it was a single six-month program for $3,500. Then I added a guided program for $6,500. Then I added a total immersion program for $9,500. Then I created Mentor Mastery, where those figures are intact at Master Mentor level, and now my figures are higher. Then I've added Mentor Summits to it. I've added Mentor Discounts to it. There's a Mentor Hall of Fame. I can go on and on. So add value, add options for people, add attraction to your creation. Number eight, stratify it on the accelerant curve. And so a lot of people tell me that I recycle, the kind of people say I repurpose things. Put this in various formats. There are different ways to coach people. There are different kinds of workshops. There are different kinds of experiences. And not just based on their length of time, but based on the value they provide. So all your workshops, all your coaching, all your teleconferences, these kinds of things don't have to be priced the same. Those of you on this teleconference know it's not part of my normal teleconference series. There's an extra charge for this. And so that's an example of taking up another space on the accelerant curve. I call it stratifying. And then finally, number nine, it's going back to this licensing idea, where this great idea you came up with might be licensable. And so if you take a look at this intellectual capital to intellectual property to income that's bankable, what I'm saying to you is create your great idea folder so you capture them. Use the filters of high impact, large audience, originality, pragmatism, and implementation. Then create your conceptual framework. What's your model, graphic, or sequence? Select the best conveyance and transfer mechanism for your particular audience, be that text, audio, video, workshops, interaction, combinations. Promote the value to your designated audience, yourself or in line with others, in association with others. That's a good opportunity for you to work with trade professional groups and associations and that alliance I talked about. Price it per value. Adjust and add formats. Stratify it on the accelerant curve. Recycle and repurpose. And then think about licensing it. So the conclusion here, or the summary points or whatever that I want to leave you with in these final couple of minutes is this. First of all, I'm going to say three things here. First of all, open your minds. That is first and foremost. It's what I started with. You have to open your mind. You have to let yourself acknowledge, believe in a recovery. A lot of this is perceptual, and your perception is most important. So you have to believe in what I'm talking about. You have to embrace it, and you have to internalize it for yourself. There's a recovery that you can help people with and provide tremendous value about. You have to create your own positive environment. You have to surround yourself with the right people. You have to listen to the right language. You have to use the right language. That is very, very important in creating your own environment. You have the power to create your own positive environment here, but only you can do that. Number two, open your markets. Reinvent your old markets with new products and new services, and create and embrace new markets with your existing products and services. But think about these sequences I've been talking about as well. Wholesale, retail, IC, IP, IB. Think about these kinds of things to help open markets. And don't be afraid of competition. Competition opens markets, doesn't narrow markets. And so the more people, the better. Don't worry about that. Just be very, very good at what you do and be original. Be provocative, be contrarian, stand out in the crowd. You have to rise above the noise. Number three, open your own potential. Expand your expertise into true thought leadership and leverage. It's time to take the lead. I mean, there's no time to take the lead, such as there is in volatility, because so many people are uncertain, so many people are scared, so many people are worried, and so many people pull in their horns that it's the best possible time to take the lead. So now's the time to put your stuff out there. And don't fall victim to this stuff, that if you put your intellectual property out there, someone will steal it, that someone will beat you to the punch, that you won't get credit. I've got news for you. It's like people who don't want to put, you know, certain details in email. If somebody wants to steal from you, they'll steal from you. People won't put their addresses, their email. If somebody wants to stalk you, they will find you. And if somebody wants to steal from you your intellectual property, they're going to steal it anyway. And so you might as well put it out there as much as you can to make it blatantly apparent to all that it's yours, right? Right. And so, you know, I've written all these books, and I've gotten more and more business from writing all these books. I put all the intellectual property out there I can. Let the very few, very, very few, you know, unethical slime balls steal it. I'll catch some of them and not others, but it doesn't matter. They're not going to get wealthy on it, and they're not taking my wealth away. The greatest benefit is that I've constantly got it out there for others to see, and they want to utilize it. And they especially want to utilize it in uncertain times. These are uncertain times, but they're trending up. Trust me. I'm as positive as you're going to see me because I think these are great times ahead. It's great to be alive. I hope you feel that way too. Thanks for joining me today. I really respect your time in doing this, and I appreciate you doing it, and I wish you all the best. Godspeed. Bye-bye.